Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Medicine, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Rachel Pagonis, your host for today's episode. Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Susan Reverby about her book, Examining Tuskegee, the Infamous Syphilis Study and Its Legacy. The book isn't new, but it's newly relevant as the Tuskegee study has re-entered popular discourse in a big way, I would say, over the last year for reasons that we'll get into in our discussion. Susan Reverby is the Marion Butler McLean Professor Emerita in the History of Ideas and Professor Emerita of Women's and Gender Studies at Wellesley College. She is a historian of American healthcare, women, race, and public health with a focus on equality and ethics. And Susan has researched and written extensively on the infamous Tuskegee syphilis study that we'll be speaking about today. And she was also part of the legacy committee that resulted in President Clinton's federal apology for the study in 1997. And additionally, in 2010, her article on the U.S. study in Guatemala in the late 1940s that involved infecting men and women with sexually transmitted diseases. And I want to make clear here, this was not part of the Tuskegee study. But her work on that study led to an apology to the Guatemalans by the Obama administration. So she's done a lot of work, research into sexually transmitted diseases and the ethics of that research. So Susan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me on again. I really appreciate it.
Sure, it's a pleasure. And you and I spoke on the show last November about your newest book, Co-Conspirator for Justice, The Revolutionary Life of Dr. Alan Berkman. But I keep hearing Tuskegee referred to in often passionate, sometimes inaccurate ways, for instance, on the radio. So I thought what a great idea to ask you back to talk about your really authoritative book on the Tuskegee study. And also, that'd be interesting to ask you to look at it in light of the present moment, which is, I think, 12 years after it was published. So before we start, would you just tell us a bit about how you got involved in researching the Tuskegee study? Because I think you spent 15 or 20 years working on it.
Yeah, more time than I care to think about. So I started out as a historian of women and nursing, and I was fishing around for a second project. And I actually happened to see a play called Miss Evers Boys, which is a fictionalization of the Tuskegee study based on a fictionalized telling of the story of a woman named Eunice Rivers Laurie, who becomes the African-American nurse who's the go-between the men in Tuskegee, Alabama, and the public health service. So maybe I should just stop here for a second. Let me explain what the study is for people who don't know, and then I can explain how I got interested.
Yeah, great.
So in the elevator version of the story, in the mid-1930s, there was beginning to be discussion about whether or not the treatment for syphilis, which is a sexually transmitted disease, was worse than the disease itself. And at that point, we were using heavy metals and mercury, bismuth, something called nearsophenamine to supposedly cure the disease. And there was really uncertainty about whether it worked or not, especially if people survived to the third stage of the disease where it affected other parts of their bodies, but it was no longer contagious. That is, you couldn't give it to anybody else. So there had been a study in the early 1910s where a physician in Oslo had tracked white people who had had the disease to see whether or not the treatment made any difference. And he argued that the treatment really didn't matter. So there was an interest in seeing if that was true for African-Americans as well, because the assumption in the 20s and 30s was that African-Americans were, quote unquote, a syphilis-soaked race, unquote. And it was also assumed that the disease was different in Blacks and whites, that is, that Black people got the cardiovascular complications from the disease and white people got the neurological complications. So a study, some treatment studies were done in the late 1920s in a couple of counties in the South, and then the Depression hit, there was no money. But the United States Public Health Service thought, wow, we know that there's some disease in this county in Alabama. Why don't we go back and see whether or not, if we don't treat, it will actually make no difference. So they rounded up, in the end, approximately 400 African-American men, and they only did men because they were concerned about if women were pregnant, then you'd have to worry about the fetus. And they only did men because the first sign of syphilis is usually a sore on whatever part of the body got transmitted sexually. So it was easier for men to see a sore on their penises than it was for women to see the sore inside their vaginas. So men just were easier to use. So they only looked at African-American men. They found approximately 400 men with the disease and about 200 men without it. And they made the decision to just keep following them for a length of time. And part of the problem was they didn't tell the men, of course, that they were in an experiment or a research project. They told them that they were being treated for their bad blood. And what they were being treated with was not the standard treatment, but in fact, aspirin, some vitamin tonics, things like that, and some vitamins. And then they were also brought into the hospital in Tuskegee and given diagnostic spinal taps to see whether or not they had neurological complications. And they were told that it was a special treatment. So the study starts and then it keeps going and it keeps going. And in the 1940s, during the war, if you were drafted, you would be tested for STDs. And so they asked the local draft board not to draft any of these men. The civil rights movement starts in the late 40s, early 50s, right in Tuskegee and nearby in Montgomery during the bus boycott. The study keeps going. And the study keeps going through the period in which we start using penicillin, which is discovered in the mid-1940s to be a cure for early syphilis. They don't give the men penicillin either. They just keep the study going. And finally, it doesn't end until 1972, when another sexually transmitted diseases investigator found out about the study, was so horrified and couldn't get them to stop it that he gave the story to a newspaper reporter friend of his. And then it went out on the Associated Press wire and all hell broke loose about how this study had now gone on for 40 years. So the key concepts in the study are, A, it was a study of non-treatment, even though the men were told they were being treated. It was only African-American men. And thirdly, the men already had the disease. No one was given syphilis by the government. They already had it when they were inducted into the study. So that's the short version of it. And it comes to light in 1972, around the same time as there's beginning to be lots of discussion about bioethics issues and the beginning realization that the terrible things that often happen in American medical research are not done by the monster doctors, but are in fact done by the so-called good guys who just seize an opportunity, think it's a really important study, and lose sight of who and what's going on. So Tuskegee comes at the end of a series of studies like that. And so there is more and more discussion and finally a set of rules that are promulgated that really ask for both issues of equality and justice when it comes to medical research. So that's why Tuskegee becomes so important.
Yeah, and that set of rules you're referring to, that's the Belmont Report?
That's correct. So it's a report about what are the principles we should use. And that involves making sure there's informed consent and making sure that there's some kind of equity in the way we do this and a call for justice in the kinds of research we do.
Hmm. Yeah. One thing that's interesting to me about that, the informed consent, because that was a big issue here, although as you write, it wasn't the only issue. you know, did the men truly give informed consent? What, why don't we just address that? Did the men give any kind of informed consent? I mean, when the study started, there were no guidelines whatsoever.
No, I mean, there was the assumption that you wouldn't harm people. And certainly with some surgical procedures, you still had to sign. So the thing that's interesting about Tuskegee is one of the ways they could prove that the men had syphilis wasn't just all the various blood tests, but when people died, you could see the damage on their organs. So the public health service really wanted autopsies. So in order to induce the families to agree to sign consents, actually, for an autopsy, they gave them money. So they promised to help pay for the funerals. So the families got about $200, which would have paid for some of the, you know, for the funeral expenses if they agreed to the autopsy. So the only consent in the study was when they were dead.
That sounds kind of creepy, going into a study, you know, when you die from this disease, we'll pay for your funeral.
Yes. It's pretty creepy. It's definitely up there in creepiness. But on the other hand, it's also a time period where this kind of, you know, it's interesting. So my father was a solo practicing physician, but he did a little research on penicillin early on in his career. And in 1946, he was doing a study on bacterial endocarditis, which is a bacterial infection of the heart, in which in the days before penicillin, you would literally die from it. So I said to my father, what kind of informed consent did you give the patients when you tried this new drug? And he said, I told the patients, if they didn't try this new drug, they'd die. So that wouldn't pass as informed consent today, but in 1946, clearly he was being honest. He was telling him it was a new drug and we didn't know whether it would work or not, but here's your zero sum, example. And in Tuskegee, they didn't tell the men what they were doing. They didn't tell them they weren't being given what we would now call standard of care. They weren't being given standard of care. They were being ignored.
Yeah.
And they didn't try to hide it. The other thing that's interesting about Tuskegee is that there were 12 reports in major medical journals about it. Although by the late 40s and 50s, the later reports all refer to the men as volunteers. So you wouldn't really know that they hadn't been told.
But it got very complicated too, didn't it? Because some of the men did, we believe, you believe, got some penicillin treatment at some point over the 40 years.
Right. I mean, so the other thing to remember is we tend to think of Tuskegee the way we do about the concentration camp, experiments during the Second World War. But, Macon County, Alabama is not a concentration camp. And people were part of the Great Migration out of the rural South in the interwar and then the post-war period. And so people left Alabama. And some people who even stayed got to treatment. So it wasn't as if the Public Health Service had this total control over them, as it wasn't as if Nurse Rivers knew where they were every second. And I found evidence and argue in the book that I think she also helped some of the men get out of the study, that she knew it was wrong. And so she was essentially telling them where else to go to get treatment. So I think some of that was happening as well. So the study's just from a scientific point of view, it's a disaster, because it's also true that when some of the controls got sick, if they got syphilis, they were switched into the other arm of the study. But if a man proved to not really have syphilis, let's say you do the autopsy and discover he doesn't have any damage, then maybe you had a false positive in the blood test, they didn't switch them into the control arm. So the data is a mess. And nothing really scientific was ever learned from this.
Wow. And after all of that, 40 years.
After 40 years. Yes.
Wow.
What we learned was what not to do, but not what to do. That's the lesson.
You think, oh gosh. But before we get more into that, could you tell us more about Nurse Rivers? Because she was maybe the best known protagonist in the history of this study. I don't know if that's because of the play that came out that subsequently became an HBO film, but she seems to have kind of an outsized role. So what?
Yeah, and partly it's also a historical artifact. That is, the first history book about Tuskegee was written by my colleague Jim Jones, who was at the University of Houston. And in a book with a million, goes on for 40 years, there's lots of details and lots of doctors' names, right? As you can imagine, hundreds of people come in and out. But he wrote a whole chapter about Rivers, because he got to interview her before she passed away. And then when David Felshew, the playwright and physician, wrote Miss Evers Boys, which becomes the play and then the movie on HBO, he centers it on her. So I think that's part of the fascination, and she becomes sort of the only visible woman in the study, even though there are others. And secondly, I think it's because we have this sort of weird expectation that somehow this African-American nurse would stop it, that somehow, so in Tuskegee, like in a lot of Southern cities and small towns, there's a Confederate statue, for example, in the main square. And until the late 60s, African-American people weren't even supposed to walk in front of it because it's a statue of a Confederate soldier. So, you know, I keep saying to people, what would you want her to do? Stand in the main square where she can't walk in front of the Confederate statue and start screaming her head off? Nobody would have listened. They would have carted her off. Somebody else would have replaced her and the whole thing would have continued. So, you know, I think she did what she thought she could do to help throughout the study. But I think people are fascinated by her because they want her to stop it. They don't quite understand why she would do it all those. And she does it for the whole length of the study.
Yeah. And she was quite close to a lot of the men. And also you quoted, I believe it was a former student of hers who then became her supervisor in the hospital, who said that she was a sort of a Harriet Tubman in that she did sort of ferry some men into treatment with penicillin without letting the study coordinators know.
That's exactly right. I mean, Jim Jones and I have this argument about it all the time because he interviewed her and I did not. She had passed by the time I started to work on it. And so he says he doesn't think she did that, but I thought I had enough evidence from both the interview with the woman who had worked with her to some things that were written by the Public Health Service. And then the obvious question when you interview, one of the men talks about going to a special treatment center in Birmingham. And when he gives the testimony, he says, and I was sent to Birmingham. And then everybody's horrified because he gets there and then he gets called out of the line there. And this is a very dramatic moment also in the play and in the movie. And then he's sent back to Tuskegee. So you have this sense of him like a kind of medical slave, right? That gets to the north, to the Mason, north of the Mason-Dixon line, but he gets recaptured and sent back home. Except nobody was being treated in this rapid treatment center who was in the advanced stages of the disease because they were no longer contagious. And secondly, this gentleman ended up getting pneumonia in the 1950s. And so he gets 10 days worth of IV penicillin. Anyway, but the third question is when he says in his interview, they sent me to Birmingham, it suddenly dawned on me that none of us had asked him, who sent you to Birmingham? How did he know to go? Right. It's not like he would have Googled it. Right. There was no Googling. There was no internet. Right. So who told him to go get treated? So if the study was such a secret and if Rivers didn't help anybody, how the hell did he get out in the first place? Hmm. So that's the questions I've been raising to just to make it a bit more complicated than the assumption that the men had no other options. So, you know, there was some attempt at follow up when they left the county, but it wasn't, no one was sort of told not to treat them, you know? So I think a number of them, if they survived into the antibiotic era, probably got to some kind of haphazard treatment because in the 40s and 50s, if you sneezed and got to a doctor, you probably got a shot of penicillin.
Right. Which again, as you say, just totally messes up the study. I was trying to come up with a word that I can use in public.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Right. Yes. On the air. Right.
Yes, on the air.
Clean version of this. Yes. This was not a science. I mean, it was a study. As I said, what it shows us is what happens when arrogance gets in the way and when your racism makes you think that you have the right to do this. And so how I got into it was that I knew about the study. I mean, anybody doing any kind of justice work or history of medicine would know about the study after 1972. And then I had done some work on my first dissertation book was on the history of nursing. And I was thinking about writing something about Rivers herself. And I saw the play, talked to the playwright, went to Tuskegee and discovered that the playwright made up this whole section of the play is about her giving testimony at a Senate hearing around the study, but she never testified. So there just wasn't enough material to do a whole book on her. And there also, I began to think, I don't want her to carry the weight of this. And so what I began to think about a lot is, well, why do people keep referring to Tuskegee? Why is it important? So the book ended up having sort of three sections, one just sort of retelling what happened, then a section sort of explaining all the people who were involved in it, and then a third section looking at how does an idea like this travel? How does knowledge of this travel into American culture? And what role does it play? So that's what the book was about.
Yeah, and there's some really interesting, the last section, which gets into the popular, both how it was delivered the story was revealed in the press, and also the first books that were written about it, including Jim Jones's Bad Blood and the play that came out, and how that shapes, you read about how that shapes not only people's understanding, but people's memories.
Right, exactly. I mean, there's an amazing, there's a little film done by, I think it was a TV show, but I think it was on ABC, called Prime Time. So the way that they set the show up is there still were a number of the men have all passed away now, but there were still, you know, a dozen or so men still alive when this was done in the early 90s. And so they show them going to see the play and seeing themselves portrayed, you know, on the stage. And so, you know, it raises these interesting psychological questions of then, how much do you remember about what really happened to you? How different is it from what you see on the in the play? What is it that your lawyer, because it was a lawsuit, what is it that your lawyer tells you you should tell the court in your affidavit, because all the men's affidavits are exactly the same? You know, there's just all of those issues. So, you know, the question then becomes, what is it that people really do remember about their own experience? And how does that travel to?
Yeah, and it's I found that last section really fascinating, because you go into some depth about the play itself and how it was, as you say, it was a dramatized history or a historical drama. So there were a lot of liberties taken with the facts, right, to get the message that the playwright wanted to deliver across. And what was the message that the playwright wanted?
Well, he really wanted people to know something about the study, and he thought having it, you know, dramatized this way would get the ethics of it really, you know, the lack of ethics of it across in a kind of sympathetic way. But for example, some of the men in Tuskegee, so one of the ways that the playwright does it, because if you think about it, you have to dramatize the impact of syphilis. So in the neurological complications, it means you often have a neurological damage, and so your leg doesn't quite work, and you have a drag on one of your legs sometimes. So he has the men have a dance troupe, which is why the play is called Miss Evers Boys, because that's the name of their dance troupe. And so some of the men were really quite horrified by this and gave a statement that said they didn't see themselves as dancing boys. They thought this was racist. And so the poor playwright, who had used this as a way to dramatize the problem, got into some hot water in Tuskegee itself over trying to dramatize it in this particular way, which unfortunately fit into certain stereotypes about African-Americans as dancers and musical and all of those kinds of issues.
Yeah. And in that sense, he may have been caught up in, as we all inevitably are, in the times, which is that was his, you know, those were maybe the kind of things that he would refer to convey dramatically what happened. And also in the news shows, the Primetime Live, and there was another one on Nova, I think.
Right. Deadly Deception.
Yeah, and you write about also, too, how those were edited to portray particular things, which it seemed to be a lot of it was not that the Public Health Service and the CDC were behaved well through this thing, I'll say, but demonizing the doctors kind of individually,
yes.
I think.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And they didn't help themselves either. I mean, some of it was, you know, you would think someone would have said to them, listen, it happened a long time ago. Now's time to say, you know, it was a long time ago. We thought about things differently. But these guys get on. I mean, part of the reason we ended up forming the Legacy Committee and getting the apology is that we watched one of these films. It was done, actually, a BBC film was done as well in the early 90s. And they interview several of the physicians, and they're on there, and they're not saying, gee, we're really sorry, we shouldn't have done it. They're saying, we did a good study. It was a good thing. We were really trying to help. We were on a war against syphilis. We were really trying to find out what was going on. These people did good things for their race, blah, blah. And, you know, we're all sitting there with our eyes getting bigger and bigger, like saucers, going, oh my God, I can't believe they're still saying this. This is outrageous. We need an apology. And that's what the push was, because we were so freaked out by their failure to apologize.
Yeah, and
pretty
one
I mean, pretty dumb. Yeah. Just, you know, you wonder where their PR, you know, their public relations. I mean, nobody obviously talked to the right person who said, you know, just shut up or refuse to talk or, you know, apologize, even if you don't believe it. But they didn't. So they just showed themselves. It was really stunning.
Yeah. You wonder if that was something necessary for them to avoid cognitive dissonance, that this is what they've devoted so many years of their life and their identity to. I was just going to mention the one character, Sidney Olansky, who was from the Public Health Service.
Uh-huh.
And he didn't come across very well throughout. And I was thinking that's perhaps because I think this was in the 1960s when he said this, but you quoted him as saying, this was meant to be a progressive study with the hope that as it went along, we would pick up interesting things, with the important thing being what actually kills them. And he said that, I believe it was well after penicillin had been introduced. Yeah. So, but then also when he was interviewed, I think it was in the prime time, he was, as you say, not apologetic, defending the study the whole way.
Right. Oh, no. And it was just horrible. And people were really horrified because he was this very famous dermatologist now in private practice in Atlanta. And his sons, I think, also were in practice with him. And he just, you know, when that thing came out in the early 90s, people were just completely furious at him. You know, but I think, so what I try to do when I talk to particularly medical personnel, students or, you know, physicians about the study, and I say, look, obviously you don't want to do what these people did, but I want you to think about how easy it would be to be them, to get so caught up in the importance of your own research that you forget who's standing in front of you and what it means for them. And I think that's the important lesson here is less, oh my God, these are monsters. And the reason I say that is because when Jim Jones was doing his book, he interviewed one of the physicians who was no longer around when I was doing mine, but he said to him, well, why didn't the studies, the Nuremberg trials give you pause, right? Why didn't you stop? And the physician looked at him like he was out of his mind. And he said to Jim, but they were Nazis. And so that's really resonated with me. And I think what I really worry about is, so it's too easy with a lot of these studies to say, okay, this happened a long time ago. You know, we used to be racist, but we're not anymore, you know, blah, blah, blah. I would never do anything like this. And I think our job as a historian, my job as a historian is to help people understand that these weren't monsters, really. They really thought they were doing the right thing. Why did they think that? And how might we learn about the mistakes that get made when you think you're doing the right thing, not when you're doing the wrong thing? So I think that's really important about these studies. All of these guys thought what they were doing really mattered and would help in the end.
Did they actually, you said it was a disaster as a study, and I mean, did they produce anything that did help further our knowledge about syphilis?
Not really. I mean, what we knew in the end is that the disease often, it wasn't like AIDS before, you know, we had the antiretrovirals. Not everybody dies from it. There was an adage that if a man had survived syphilis for 25 years, he was to be congratulated, not treated. So if you already have neurological damage, the penicillin probably isn't going to reverse it. If you have an aneurysm in your heart, the penicillin isn't going to fix that. So the idea is to get to you before any of those things sort of really happen. So did we learn anything? No, we learned that we basically, a certain percentage of them will die from the disease. That's what we learned. We already knew that in 1932.
We knew that, yeah. One of the other things that I have wondered about this study, and I think other people would wonder is, so over the years, over the many years, there were several efforts actually to lodge complaints about the study with the Public Health Service or the CDC. And Peter Buxton, who was the one who eventually did get the story to a journalist, had also been working on, I mean, he'd been trying for quite a long time. So why weren't people more successful in getting attention drawn to the study?
You know, it's really interesting. I mean, there, you know, so in the 50s, people start raising some questions, other physicians write them, but most of those people were sort of more junior at that point and were basically told, this is being run by really senior people in the field, you don't want to cross them. You should shut up. So that's what happened. There was an attempt by a civil rights Black Power group, but it was kind of half-hearted. They did a press conference. They sent out a press release, but they didn't even do a press conference and nobody came, nobody picked it up. And, you know, they would invite people. Lansky invited people down to see what he was doing. I mean, they didn't think they were doing anything wrong. And so it took a while for people to understand it. And Peter Buxton really did try. He was actually even brought to Atlanta to talk to people about the study and was essentially told to shut up and go home. And there was a meeting in 1969 where they really did think about stopping the study. And the CDC director then sent two public health advisors to Tuskegee, not to talk to the men, mind you, but to talk to the Black physicians in the county. at a meeting, and it isn't exactly clear because nobody could find ever any minutes from that meeting, whether what they really said or not. And so they came back, and the CDC made the decision that if they ended the study, then they couldn't keep providing any of the money for the autopsies and the funerals. And they felt like they owed that to the men who were still in the study. So they kept it going for another couple of years until Buxton's story made the news.
Hmm.
It's really stunning.
Yeah. And I wonder, I'd like to talk about too, what the effect is today, because as I said, a few months ago, I heard someone on the radio saying that this was a study where men had been infected with syphilis. So, you know, you tried to clear that's not how it was, but obviously there's a message, if not a narrative out there that people are picking up, and it's been linked since COVID. It's been linked to the fact that there's vaccine hesitancy, particularly among African Americans. But you've just written or just published a paper where you dispute that. So could you say something about the relationship between Tuskegee study in the American psyche and of African Americans and vaccine hesitancy?
Right. So we know once the states actually for a while, they weren't even keeping the data by race, but we started to then have some better epidemiological work. So we knew that the disease was affecting Native Americans, Latinx people, and African Americans at higher rates. So there was immediately this concern about why the disease was more, COVID was more widespread in those communities. And then as the vaccine rollout starts to be planned, there starts to be discussion of what's called vaccine hesitancy. That is when people were asked, they seemed a little bit hesitant, mind you, during the Trump administration, mostly why people wouldn't try the vaccines. And when journalists started to write about this, or even health people, they did it without doing any research, really. They just said, well, there's all this racism in the history of what's happened. And they would name essentially three studies, the first one being Tuskegee usually. So Tuskegee would be mentioned. Dr. Marion Sims, who operated on slave women without anesthesia during the 1840s. And then the story of Henrietta Lacks, whose cells were used to create the first cell lines that we use in research. So those three stories started to circulate again in all of these newspaper accounts. And I keep a running Google alert on Tuskegee syphilis, and it usually, you know, one or two things every couple of weeks. And then starting with COVID, there would be hundreds of things in my alert, right, mm-hmm. about it. So it's suddenly, you know, and what happens often in sort of social media journalism these days, one person says it, then the next person writing about it, because they've got to meet a deadline in the next 20 minutes, right? They have time to do it, spend like I did 20 years thinking about this, right? They write it up and they rely on whatever the last person just said. And that seems like a good idea. That explains it, right? And bammo, there it was. And it was even in a Saturday Night Live routine a couple of weeks ago where they were doing a show about why there was Black hesitancy, and Tuskegee again gets mentioned as the reason. Why? And so in this article, my colleague Evelyn Hammonds and I argue that it isn't about Tuskegee, that keeping relying on that is a way to look into the past rather than acknowledge what's happening now, what people's experiences in the current period are with the racism baked into the American medical system, the assumptions about racial differences between Blacks and whites, and also the way people are treated constantly or not treated because they don't have access. So we argued that the issue isn't about Tuskegee at all. And if people invoke it, it's sometimes just laziness in terms of the way journalists or health people use it. But also if people of color use it, it's often as a way to say it's really about racism. They just use Tuskegee as a kind of way to say that without knowing any of the details of the study. I mean, it'll be 50 years next year that it ended. So how much could people really super remember exactly what happened?
Mm. Yeah, and it would be interesting to know, to go out into communities and find out what people actually do know about the study.
Right, and even if they know something, it doesn't translate. So someone was enterprising enough, I think it was an NPR study, where somebody went to Tuskegee right? Those, and then started to ask people in Tuskegee. And it was the same. I mean, you know, so, you know, people ask me, well, how did the study affect people in Tuskegee? And I said, look, it's just like there isn't a Black community. There isn't a response to the experience of having even a family member. So one of my colleagues down there, for example, her cousins were all in the study, and she, you know, came to terms with it, understood why it happened, and got involved in doing more memorializing about the study in the community. And then another man I met, his uncle and his father were in it, and then his parents' marriage fell apart. And he said, well, it was caused by my father being in the study. And I thought, well, you know, marriages fall apart for very complicated reasons always, and who knows what really happened in this marriage, but it's, it becomes the story that that family tells about the father's sort of shame of being in the study that then causes the marriage to fall apart. So who knows, right? So there isn't one reaction, just like there's not one Black community or there isn't one Tuskegee community either. People have very different reactions based on all sorts of sociological and political and individual reasons.
Yeah, and so, and in that paper, you argue that it's much more important that we look at the systemic racism that's been entered into the way people receive medical care or medical taking diagnosis, et cetera.
Exactly. I mean, just all of the assumptions. So I keep laughing. So my husband's African-American, and every time he goes for healthcare, if something goes wrong, we get this rap that goes, so blah, blah, because you're African-American, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and my eyes start getting bigger and bigger, you know. As that's happening, and he's looking, he's very shy, so he's looking at me going, please don't, you know, get into a screaming fight, right? And I'm not, but I want to write this essay. I'm going to threaten to write it. I actually think I'll do it. So his family's from Virginia, so the joke in the family is that they're related to Thomas Jefferson, right? So I'm going to write this essay that's called My Husband's Thomas Jefferson Gene Problem, because there is no way to know what ails him comes from the Jefferson genes, right? The white raped dreams of the slave owners who owned his family in the past, or from some long distant African, you know, ancestor, who knows, right? Yeah. So, I mean, but they make this assumption, it's like a one drop medical rule that if you're African-American at all in any percentage, that somehow there's some genetic difference. And I'm hopeful that in fact, that COVID will help us bury the genetic assumptions about difference by race, that it will help people understand that the people who got sicker here were people who had to go to work, who had to use public transportation, who didn't have access to healthcare, who couldn't work from home, who lived in overcrowded housing. All of those things led to disease transmission, not vulnerability. And if there were more vulnerability because they were overweight or had diabetes or other comorbidities, it's because all of those conditions actually led to those diseases in the first place.
Yeah, so much more about the social determinants of health versus...
Precisely. So that's the only hope I have out of all of these terrible deaths would be that at least we can explain more of what goes on from the poor medical care that people get often in Black communities and lack of access and just all of the history of the structural racism that affects all the social determinants of health.
Mm. So one last thing I wanted to ask you about, towards the end of the book, you write about two historians who established the narrative of the study, who are Alan M. Brandt and James Jones, who you mentioned before. And you say of them, each historian would be captive to passions the study aroused in the politics of the 1970s and the evidence then available. So my question to you is, what passions do you think will hold historians captive when they consider this study in our present moment today of, for instance, widespread awareness of COVID-19 disparities and the impetus of the Black Lives Matter movement?
It's a great question, Rachel. I have to think about that. I mean, I'm hoping that it will make people understand the social disparities that lead to the men in the study joining in the first place. So one of the things I wrote about, I wrote an essay about this when there was a debate about the Affordable Care Act was first happening, for example. And some of the Republicans were doing things like sponsoring ads in Black communities that said things like, remember the Tuskegee study? This is what happens when the government gets involved in your healthcare. So I wrote this essay that said, look, if the men in Tuskegee had had access to universal health insurance, right, if we had had the National Health Insurance Program then, none of them would have signed up. They signed up because they were being promised free health care. That's what the promise was. I mean, they were promised that they're not only would their bad blood be treated, but Rivers really functions as their private public health nurse. And so so what I argued was that they agreed to it because they were going to get health care. So I think one of the things that hopefully COVID will help us think about is that again. That is, why would the men agree to do it? What were the social conditions that led them to having the disease in the first place? I mean, as I said to my students, all it means, they didn't have any more sex than you do. It just means they didn't have access to condoms. If they had access to more condoms, they wouldn't have passed the disease on. Right? So, you know, there's just all of those kinds of issues that need to be explored. And I'm hoping that our consciousness about the differences around COVID will help people think some more about what happened in Tuskegee and for what those reasons were.
And we'll have to wait for the historians to tell us.
Yes, right. Right. To be continued. Right?
To be continued. We'll have you back, Susan.
Yeah, right. In 20 years, as my mother would say, from your mouth to God's ear.
Exactly. Well, thanks so much, Susan. I think that's really enlightening. And I want to let people know about the book. It's called Examining Tuskegee, the Infamous Syphilis Study and Its Legacy. And it's really deeply, deeply researched. And as you've heard over so many years, and so many of those questions have been answered. The only one we don't know is how will this be seen in 20 years?
Yep.
Okay. Well, thanks again so much, Susan, for being with us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for the opportunity.